Hello, this is Mary Mullen reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, August 8th, 2019. Emerging details. Recovery remains nearly impossible, but investigators open to try. The family of slain University of Illinois scholar Yingying Zhang acknowledges the near impossibility of her remains ever being found. However, an attorney working with them said those investigating Ms. Zhang's death are willing to consider an attempt to recover her remains from a landfill in Danville, assuming they are there. They, prosecutors, discussed with us that at this stage, with decomposition and compaction, the size of the remains could be smaller than a cell phone, Urbana attorney Steve Beckett said. Appearing at a news conference Wednesday at his Urbana office with Ms. Zhang's family and their Chicago-based Chinese lawyer, Xingdong Wang, Beckett tried to explain for reporters what the family has learned in the wake of the conviction and life sentence for Brent Christensen. Beckett said that attorneys for Christensen did not file an appeal, meaning that the case is over and Christensen will spend the rest of his life in a federal prison, and that the lawyers for him and the government should be free to talk about the decisions they made in the last 2 years. The family, Beckett said, learned in a July 25th meeting with federal prosecutors that Christensen's attorneys had told the government in November 2018 how he disposed of Ms. Zhang's body after murdering her on June 19th. 2017. According to Christensen's attorneys, Christensen told them that he placed her bodily remains in three separate garbage bags. The next day, June 10, 2017, he placed those garbage bags in the dumpster immediately outside his apartment building in Champaign, Beckett said, reading from a prepared statement. On June 12, 2017, he placed Yingying's clothing, backpack, cell phone, books, and other personal items, along with cleaning materials he had used to try to cover up the murder, into a large duffel bag. He then drove around the Champaign-Urbana area and placed the items from the duffel bag into various dumpsters, placed the duffel bag itself in a dumpster at the end. Beckett said the government learned that the first pickup of garbage was June 12, 2017, the same day Christensen put the personal effects in the dumpster and 2 days after he put the body parts in it. The contents went to a private landfill in the Danville area, Beckett said, and before being transported to Danville, the contents were compacted at least twice. Christensen's credibility. That 2 years have passed since then makes the recovery of any remains complicated and expensive. It would require government oversight and the cooperation of the landfill owners, and would have no certainty of success. To date, no search has been undertaken, but the Zhang family understands that the authorities are still considering an attempt to locate and recover Yingying's remains, he said. Asked if the family was pushing for such an attempt, Beckett said, "The prosecution has indicated the strong desire of the investigating agencies to go forward with the search. The family welcomes that." But Wang stressed for the approximately three dozen journalists present Wednesday that what the prosecutors know was relayed to them from the lawyers from Christensen. "Christensen lied so many times. We don't believe the attorneys lied, but no one can say for sure that Christensen told his attorneys the truth," Wang said. The government first learned the news of where the remains were in November 2018 from Christensen's attorneys, who agreed to provide it under immunity, in hopes that the government would take the death penalty off the table, Beckett said. He explained that immunity means that the information and any evidence derived from it could not be used in the criminal trial or sentencing. It was relayed by Christensen's attorneys to government attorneys, not Christensen to federal agents. However, Beckett said the defense attorneys maintained that the information they gave prosecutors came from Christensen himself. Because the information came under immunity, the prosecutors felt bound not to share it with anyone, including the family, even though the immunity was ultimately rejected by government officials because the information could not be verified. In the meantime, the family is working with the U of I to add personal effects of their daughter and sister to a memorial garden on South Goodwin Street created after her death. "We have decided to follow Chinese custom and create a gravesite here in America to honor Yingying's memory," her father, Ron Gao Zhang, said after reading from a brief statement. "We want to thank everyone for helping to look for Yingying." However, based on what we have been told by the authorities, we think the best thing to do now is to let them look into the feasibility of recovering Yingying's remains. We now understand that finding her may be impossible, the elder Zong said. We are really miserable. It took Zong about 5 minutes to deliver his brief remarks, as they were translated from English to Chinese for the benefit of Chinese reporters present and Ms. Zong's mother and brother. Lai Feng Yi, Beckett revealed, learned only Wednesday morning prior to the news conference the grisly details of what happened to her only daughter's body. There had been a concerted effort to shield her from that information during the trial and afterwards. But he said she wanted to be present at the news conference. At the beginning of the news conference, Yi held her head down, a tissue clutched in her hand, covering her sobs. After the prepared statements were read and the questions began, she had to be helped from the crowded room, her sobs audible until she got behind a closed door. Her son, Xing Yang Zong, had held her hand and rubbed her back lovingly up to that point. Asked to describe the family's emotions about the way the information on the remains was handled, Zong said, "We are really miserable. You see my wife, she cannot control herself when she heard the news." Asked when they might return to China, Zong said they have not made a decision. When we find her, we will leave, he said. Well, that was certainly a sad story. We have Jim Dai's column. Professor's fight over his firing comes up way short. In the end, a former professor Louis Wozniak's legal battle with the University of Illinois is not here, is certainly near. In the scathing 7-page opinion issued Tuesday, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago upheld the dismissal of Wozniak's wrongful termination lawsuit against the U of I. It found that Wozniak, a longtime tenured professor in the College of Engineering, created the grounds for his 2013 firing when he waged an extended campaign against students who did not give him an award and ignored directives from his superiors to cease and desist. Inconsiderate and insubordinate is the most charitable description one can attach to his conduct, Justice Frank Easterbrook wrote for a unanimous 3-member panel. Justices Diane Wood and David Hamilton joined in the decision. A 50-year member of the engineering faculty, Wozniak was the first tenured faculty member to be dismissed by the U of I since the 1960s. His dismissal stems from Wozniak-driven controversy over a teaching award made annually by two student honor societies. A previous winner, Wozniak was exorcised when a 2009 award went to one of his colleagues, Ali E. Abbas. Wozniak thought he should have received the award and set out to investigate, Easterbrook wrote. In doing so, Wozniak aggressively interrogated the head of one honor society and got her to cry. He conducted additional questioning of a U of I employee who did not cry but was distressed. He then posted on his website information criticizing the student heads of the honor societies and enabling readers to determine their identities. That violated university policies as well as conditions attached to the university's federal grants, Easterbrook wrote. Ultimately, Wozniak filed a lawsuit in state court over the award. Wozniak, who was represented by Naperville lawyer Stuart Polizzi, argued his dismissal violated his free speech right to address issues of public concern and that he was denied his due process right to defend himself at a termination hearing before U of I trustees. The appeals court found Wozniak's free speech argument unpersuasive because he was fired for intentionally causing hurt to students and refusing to follow the dean's instructions, not simply for publicizing the effects of his actions. Noting that Wozniak had two hearings, one before a faculty committee and one before the U of I board, the justices rejected Wozniak's due process claim. At each, he was represented by counsel and allowed to call witnesses and present arguments, Easterbrook wrote. Wozniak filed his lawsuit against the U of I in 2015. After it was dismissed by U.S. Judge Colin Bruce, he appealed to the Seventh Circuit. Now his legal options, at least in this lawsuit, have dwindled. He can ask the appeals court to reconsider its decision. He asked the Seventh Circuit to conduct an en banc review. Finally, he can ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the appellate court's decisions. Given the unanimous appellate court opinion, none of those alternatives appears viable. This particular matter is over, said U of I lawyer William Brinkman, who said Wozniak certainly has the right to continue to pursue the litigation, but suggested his chances of success are nil. Brinkman said he was pleased with everything in the appellate court opinion. I can't say I'm surprised at the tone, he said. Wozniak, who was unaware of the court's ruling, declined comment. I have not seen the judgment, and I would not be ready to discuss it, he said. Wozniak's lawyer did not respond to inquiries. The veteran professor had a long history of disputes with colleagues in the engineering departments, engaging in conduct that was widely criticized for being unreasonable. Nonetheless, a faculty committee reviewed the dispute over the 2009 award and recommended Wozniak not be dismissed because the punishment would be excessive. Being a self-righteous, obsessed, and insensitive person is not a cause to dismiss, the faculty committee concluded. U of I administrators, however, continued to pursue dismissal, and after reviewing the matter, trustees agreed. College admission scandal. Hearings intent clear on aid policy. Don't. Two Illinois House committees will hold a joint hearing today in Chicago on the subject of wealthy parents who put their teenage children into guardianship in order to qualify for financial aid. As of Wednesday, it remained to be seen whether any of the attorneys or parents involved in that practice will show up to testify. But even if they don't, Representative LaShawn Ford, Democrat Chicago, who chairs the House committee that deals with funding higher education, said he hopes the hearing itself will deter other parents from trying it in the future. Bringing awareness to the issue should deter it in a big way, Ford said Wednesday. The issue came to light in a story published July 29th by the nonprofit investigative news organization ProPublica Illinois. Reporters found dozens of cases of parents in wealthy Chicago suburbs of Lake County who had petitioned a court to place their children in the custody of guardians, often a family friend or relative, so their children could declare themselves financially independent and thereby qualify for student financial aid, including grants from the state's monetary award or MAP grants. Ford said he and other lawmakers had consulted with attorneys who advised them there was nothing illegal about the practice. But he said it raises a number of moral issues because the MAP program has limited funding available, and typically as many as 80,000 applicants per year are denied grants because there is not enough funding to go around. I think the families may not understand the harm that they're doing, Ford said. I don't know if they morally knew that they were robbing another student of the opportunity to go to college. Ford's committee will meet jointly with the House Higher Education Committee in a hearing set to begin at 10 a.m. in the Michael A. Blahnik Building in Chicago. According to an agenda that Ford provided, the hearing will involve four panels representing the University of Illinois, the Illinois Student Assistance Commission, other public universities, and the Partnership for College Completion, an organization that advocates for policies to help students in the Chicago area complete college. Ford said the committees had considered issuing subpoenas for representatives from law firms involved in the guardianship arrangements, as well as parents who had taken advantage of the process. But he said that process would have taken considerable time, so the committee instead invited those people to testify. As of late Wednesday, he said none of them had said they would attend. The health reporter is in. Why doesn't the diaper bank just give out cloth diapers which can be continuously reused rather than supply clients with the throwaways that end up in the landfills and hardly ever go away? The Bottom Line Diaper Bank, a nonprofit run by the United Way of Champaign County at the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District, actually does have some cloth diapers and diaper pails available for those parents that want them, according to the Public Health Administrator Julie Pride. Disposables are more popular, though, and if you think about that, it makes sense, she said. Babies go through 10 to 12 diapers a day, and cloth diapers need to be cleaned properly. The American Academy of Pediatrics advises rinsing dirty diapers in cold water, then soaping them in a mild detergent solution with bleach, then wringing them out and washing them in hot water with a mild detergent. Parents having trouble affording diapers may well lack a washer and dryer at home, and, Pride said, they're probably not going to have the resources to make several trips a week to their laundromat. Another factor to consider is that many working parents rely on daycare centers, and most childcare centers require parents to provide a day's supply of disposable diapers, according to the National Diaper Bank Network. Mary Noel Steffen, Director of Marketing and Engagement for the United Way, says parents should make their own choices about what kind of diapers are right for their babies. However, the agency believes the diaper bank can make the biggest difference with disposable diapers, she said. Parents relying on the diaper bank for help live at or close to the poverty line, Steffen said. Cloth diapers require a lot of time in the washer, and for parents working two or three jobs, that's a lot of time in the laundromat, she said. The American Academy of Pediatrics said there are also some health aspects to consider. Cloth diapers have improved over the years in terms of absorbency, but they don't keep wetness away from a baby's skin as effectively as disposables, the physician organization said. So when cloth diapers are used, it's important to change diapers very soon after they become wet or soiled to avoid diaper rash. According to the National Diaper Bank Network, disposable diapers can run a family $70 to $80 a month, and families lacking transportation to big box stores can wind up paying significantly more when they buy diapers at convenience. Mary Schenck's column, Teen Gets Prison for Apartment Arson. A 15-year-old Urbana boy who pleaded guilty to taking part in setting a fire that heavily damaged a campus town apartment has been sentenced to 15 years in prison. However, the teen may not be held beyond his 21st birthday in a Department of Juvenile Justice prison. He pleaded guilty in early July before Judge Tom DeFantis to residential arson for a fire just before midnight on June 8th at 509 East Green Street, Champaign. The fire was started in a two-wheeled garbage toter behind the building, but spread to a bank of electrical meters, heavily damaging those and prompting the landlords to shut down the building while repairs were made. Several students were displaced. The act was captured on video. In return for his plea, a more serious charge of aggravated arson was dismissed. The teen had earlier pleaded guilty to aggravated battery for an April 2nd attack on another juvenile in an alley by a gas station in the 600 block of East University Avenue, Champaign. He was out awaiting sentencing for that at the time of the arson. For that crime, DeFantis sentenced him to 5 years in prison to be served concurrently with the 15 for arson. Another charge of aggravated battery, he spat on a man at the Illinois Terminal in downtown Champaign a few hours after the apartment fire was dismissed to resolve all the criminal cases. The 15-year sentence was the same as DeFantis gave last month to a co-defendant who had also pleaded guilty to residential arson and the same aggravated battery. No restitution was ordered for the teens because insurance covered the loss, which a Bankier apartment employee earlier estimated was in the tens of thousands of dollars because of the cost of repairs and relocating tenants. The teen sentenced Wednesday had a previous adjudication for attempted armed robbery for his role in a January 2018 attack on a U of I student who was hit in the face with a brick and robbed of his wallet on the quad. Financial exploitation. Theft from relative must be repaid. A Champaign woman who admitted she stole money intended for a mentally disabled relative was sentenced Wednesday to 18 months of probation. In that time, Don Gaines, 52, who listed addresses in the 700 block of Swigert Street and also in Rockaway Beach, Missouri, will have to make restitution of $2,313, representing the amount of money that Developmental Services Center didn't receive in rent for the man for whom Gaines acted as a guardian. Gaines pleaded guilty before Weber to financial exploitation of a person with a disability, admitting that between January 2012 and March 2017, she used money intended for the 45-year-old man for her personal use. Assistant State's Attorney Joel Fletcher said the man was born with a condition that kept him from developing mentally into an adult. Fletcher said the man's IQ enables him to function only at preschool levels. Gaines admitted that she combined her own money in a checking account with funds that her relative received as pay from DSC and Social Security. However, over time, she drew out money intended for him to pay for things like her own car insurance, the prosecutor said. The matter came to the attention of authorities when DSC was not paid rent for the man's living quarters, and officials there knew he was making enough money to cover it and have cash left over. Gaines was criminally charged in February. Urbana home break-in. Fingerprint yields arrest in burglary. An Urbana man whose fingerprint was found in a home where a burglary took place in April has been criminally charged. Cervantes Laster, 18, who listed an address in the 2700 block of East Illinois Street, was arraigned Wednesday for residential burglary, a Class 1 felony carrying a prison term of between 5 and 15 years upon conviction. Champaign County Sheriff's Lieutenant Kurt Apperson said on April 8th, deputies investigating a break-in to a home in the 200 block of Pfeffer Road, Urbana. A rear door had been forced open, the home rummaged through, and a camera stolen. Deputies collected latent fingerprints and sent them to the state crime lab for comparison. Late last week, Apperson said they received information that one of the prints belonged to Laster. Deputies found him Tuesday at home and arrested him. Laster was sentenced July 23rd to 30 months of probation for a burglary that happened April 23rd. He had initially been charged with residential burglary, but it was reduced to a plea negotiation. Apperson said that between November and April, deputies investigated about 18 residential burglaries with a similar method of operation and continued to look into those. A juvenile had been arrested for at least one of those, he said. Laster appeared before Judge John Kennedy Wednesday, who set his bond at $10,000 and told him to be back in court September 10th. Champaign apartment. Man gets probation in cocaine case. A Champaign man linked to cocaine found in a Champaign apartment earlier this year has been sentenced to 2 years of probation. Martrell Mann, 29, who listed an address in the 300 block of Edgebrook Drive, pleaded guilty Wednesday to possession with intent to deliver cocaine. He admitted that on February 14th, he was responsible for about 8.6 grams of cocaine that police found in an apartment in the 2000 block of Cynthia Drive during a court-ordered search. Police went there with a search warrant and knocked, Fletcher said, and man was seen tossing a bag later found to be cocaine, to contain the cocaine as he came to the door. Charges against co-defendant Keith L. Brown, 22, of Champaign, alleging he had a gun and cocaine, were discovered in May. Fletcher said Mann's only prior conviction was for battery in 2009. We have some area update news. Rantoul asking residents about cannabis commerce. The Rantoul Village Board will be talking marijuana in a month, or at least the public will. The board will take residents' comments relating to cultivation and establishment of recreational cannabis establishments in the community. To me, this is a community decision, Village Administrator Scott Eisenhower said. This is one that we want to hear from people on both sides of the issue if that exists, just to get a feel before we start down a path if we adopt an ordinance. Earlier this year, Illinois became the 11th state to legalize cannabis and the first state in which a legislature approved commercial sales. It is necessary for a community's governing board to ban the commercial sale of recreational marijuana under the Illinois Cannabis Regulation and Tax Act before it would be prohibited. Still, residents would be able to use it legally. Eisenhower said the village is waiting until September to seek the public comments because some members of the board will be absent from the August study session. He said he hasn't heard many comments from the public about the issue, but in talking to trustees, the members of the public have talked to them. They have heard both sides. Some are against it for all the moral reasons, while others recognize the revenue it could potentially generate. The village is able to impose a 3% municipal sales tax on the sale of recreational marijuana products. The revenue would go into the village's coffers. Other area towns have had similar discussions. In Paxton, a council committee heard overwhelming support for the city to allow at least one recreational marijuana dispensary. In Gibson City, Mayor Dan Dickey said the council will wait to discuss whether to allow a dispensary to open in the community. In Monticello, meanwhile, the city council decided, like Rantoul, to seek input for residents on how to regulate the sale of marijuana for recreational use. Village of Sibley, leaky roof damaging historic items. A representative of the Sibley Business and Historical Association warned Sibley Village Board members that some valuable historic documents being stored in the village-owned land office building have been damaged as a result of the leaky roof and their unprotected storage status. Derek Babb said his group would like to have the documents stored elsewhere, but they need the village board's permission since Sibley owns the documents. Babb said the materials, which include historic volumes and photos, represent valuable information that will never be available again. Among the materials are ledgers dating back to the 1800s, which show who lived and farmed on each side of Hiram Sibley's many farms. Babb said the Hiram Sibley House Museum in Rochester, New York, does not have any of the information contained in the ledgers. There are also old photographs and school blueprints. Babb said his group has scanned some of the photographs and laminated the school blueprints using its own funds, but some photographs have molded to the point they are not scannable. Babb said the association's goals include rebinding the documents and have their ownership transferred to the group once that's done. He said the group also hopes to publish a book that reproduces some of the pages and photographs. Village Board President Jim Kearney said the land office building is currently being rented, but only on a month-to-month basis, so its status may soon change. Kearney said a village goal is to turn the building into a town museum. Kearney and trustees were reluctant to okay all of the association's plans, but they gave tacit agreement and full appreciation for its efforts to secure the documents in sealed tubs at another location until final disposition and ownership is determined at a future board meeting. Willing to give his life so others may live. Name of trooper killed in line of duty added to monument wall. The Illinois State Police, family members, and dignitaries gathered Wednesday to commemorate Trooper Gerald Ellis in the third such ceremony held at Memorial Park in Springfield in almost as many months. Mr. Ellis died March 30th in the line of duty when he intentionally used his patrol vehicle to block a car driving the wrong way down Interstate 94 in Lake County from colliding with a vehicle carrying a family. He was 36. Brendan Kelly, director of the state police, called Ellis a hero. Ellis's name was added to the monument wall, which is an everlasting reminder of the tremendous cost paid at times for the safety the force is tasked with providing citizens and communities in the state, said Jack Garcia, chairperson of the State Police Memorial Park. The names are engraved here for eternity, so all our citizens and the visitors to our state can know and hopefully understand what these brave men and women, as well as their families, have sacrificed, he added. Kelly said Mr. Ellis's death was difficult for his fellow officers. It came 2 days after Trooper Brooke Jones Story was killed while conducting a traffic stop near Freeport in Stevenson County. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, August 8th, 2019. Please stay tuned for part 2.